The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a common dragonfly has the ability to thrive in polluted water. We'll explore how one campus is developing a strategy to safely integrate artificial intelligence into instruction, and a public college in Massachusetts is taking a big step to combat food insecurity. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. As colleges and universities begin a new school year, many are grappling with how to implement and regulate the use of artificial intelligence. In the first segment of today's program, we visit Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. WAMC's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Aaron Shello-Levine has the story.
And this is like the most boring slide in the whole thing, but I feel like...
Sam Hawk is just days away from teaching his first statistic classes at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. In fact, it'll be his first time teaching anywhere as a full-fledged professor.
Sort of what I'm thinking about doing is designing a policy with my students where on the first day of class, I will give each of them a pad of Post-it notes. And display, I think what I'll do is display a question just on a slide that says, is artificial intelligence appropriate to use in this class? And then I'll give them 8 minutes. And in those 8 minutes, I will expect them to write like 15 questions.
With the explosive growth in use of AI models like ChatGPT, Hawk has been busy preparing a collaborative approach.
And so by the end of that class, the goal would be to have an idea of what questions we should answer in determining what that policy should be. And then by the second class, hopefully we will all have thought about it and we can think about it more, but the goal would be to try to answer some of those questions. And I think hopefully that would be helpful in determining what the AI policy should be.
He says because AI is so prevalent, he believes it's important to work with students to determine what role the technology should play in his classrooms.
So I don't have a policy yet. I sort of lean more towards, yeah, the students will have access to this tool, so they should gain familiarity with it. But I definitely don't want that to replace learning. You know, I don't want it to just be like, I give the students the work, they type it into the AI, they hand it back to me, and then I type their work into the AI and say, grade this for me, because then what's happening?
American Studies professor Beck Crafting is the director of Skidmore's Center for Leadership, Teaching, and Learning and runs a new faculty orientation program. She says Hawk's approach is encouraging.
Having those clear boundaries and setting a shared understanding of how to use AI is going to actually help to prevent the misuse of AI throughout the rest of the semester by the students. And they're hungry for clarity and transparency around how they're going to use it. They don't want to misuse it. Most of them are not trying to use them for nefarious ends, but they, without any instruction or guidance, could easily do so without meaning to do so.
Crafting emphasizes that there is no one-size-fits-all solution to AI in the classroom. Skidmore faculty and staff are working to adopt the new technology for various learning environments.
Well, it's really important that we don't infringe on academic freedom. And so even as I create space for training and increased literacy, I want to be clear that it is not something that we are trying to impose upon faculty or staff. It's kind of like, this is here and it's happening. We want you to understand it. And then we want you to make informed decisions about how you use it or if you use it at all or the degree to which you use it.
There are, however, some professors who are not as accepting of artificial intelligence.
I do think, you know, we all teach at Skidmore College undergraduates. And those are students of a certain age. So I believe AI can play a role for graduate students, for professional scholars, but there's a developmental or staging argument that makes me think that AI should play no role in the classroom.
English professor Barbara Black is restructuring her classes this year. No grading rubrics, since students can plug them into large language models like ChatGPT, more oral exams, and an emphasis on in-class participation.
I'm making sure, particularly my composition class, that we read about AI and its relationship to writing. I want my students not to be AI fluent, but AI literate. And what I mean by that distinction is I want them to understand that ChatGPT can take away their agency, it can take away their voice, it can rob them of the opportunity to develop something that I don't think we talk a lot about, rob them of the opportunity of taste, developing a sense of their taste. Who are the more important scholars? Who are the scholars who speak to them? Who are the authors who speak to them?
Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shello Levine for WAMC News.
This is the best of our knowledge. Students with food insecurity often suffer in the classroom. Colleges across the country have been stepping up to fight hunger on their own campuses. The largest public university in Massachusetts is among them, and recently opened a permanent facility for students and staff alike. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief James Polyoligopoulos reports from UMass Amherst.
With more student community cupboards and pantries appearing on college campuses, the University of Massachusetts Amherst has taken things a step further. Ahead of its official opening, shelves and refrigerators were loaded with produce, milk, eggs, and beef jerky, filling part of the former Newman Catholic Center space, an easily accessible spot, says Jake Crane, the pantry's manager.
Access is a huge thing, and if you don't have something that is accessible, then people won't use it, and people won't think that they can use it. And so I think having something right here on campus where people can see it, it just continues to reinforce that this is for you and that this is for everybody, and you need that.
The project took at least 2 years of planning and development. Nationally, at least 1 in 3 college students is believed to face food insecurity, the university says. Pinning down an exact figure for UMass Amherst is difficult, says Crane, who estimates as much as 25% of the university's some 32,000 students experience some degree of food insecurity. Chancellor Javier Reyes tells WAMC getting the pantry up and running was critical.
You have to start with basic needs, and food is a basic need. And when you can't just go around your day without knowing what the next meal will come from. It takes your mind away from whatever you're going to be able to do. So being able to remove that in, then it allows you to really unleash your creativity, unleash your potential without that restriction.
Calling access to food a basic human right, Liv Benezra, executive director of the nonprofit Amherst Survival Center, says the university's partnership and pantry should lead to over 2,000 people being served in its first year. The pantry itself is about the size of a small grocery mart, with veggies, canned goods, and other foods filling the shelves inside it. Each foodstuff sports a number, its respective point total. Half a dozen eggs is 1 point, while a cucumber or bok choy weighs in at 2. Again, Crane.
So the way it works is you are given a set amount of points to use each month based on the size of your household. So if you have a partner or dependents, you can shop for not only yourself, but your entire household. And so the maximum points that you can get, for example, say you're a household of 1, is 70 points. And you can spend those 70 points how you like until you run out, or it's the beginning of the next month.
2,000 students are already registered to use the pantry, which also serves another population Crane and Benezra says often goes unnoticed, university staff. Here's Benezra.
The campus pantry is not only about providing food, it is about creating access and dignity and belonging right here where students live and learn. And it is also about us recognizing the realities that many of the employees on this campus face as they are also working hard and struggling to provide for themselves and their families. It is about removing the stigma, normalizing that we all need help sometimes, and building a campus culture where everyone has their needs met and can thrive.
In addition to food drives and other donations, organizers say food from the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts will support the pantry's mission. The campus pantry is open on Tuesdays as well as Thursday through Saturday. Reporting from Amherst, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Picture this. You're walking along a city sidewalk. Up ahead, there's a small park with a pond, and the water does not exactly look inviting. But some creatures seem to be loving that still slimy water, striking blue dragonflies. What you are imagining is an insect called the Blue Dasher, and these animals have a knack for adapting to human-altered environments. To learn more, I spoke with Manpreet Kohli, an evolutionary biologist at Baruch College.
Blue Dasher, which is Pachydiplex longipennis, is a species of dragonfly in the family Libellulidae. And Libellulidae are one of the most diverse types of dragonflies that you find out there. So if you've seen a dragonfly just walking around in a pond, you've most likely seen a Libellulidae dragonfly, and likely a Blue Dasher if you're here in New York or, you know, in Jersey, if you're walking around. So this is it's a small-ish dragonfly, medium to smallish sized dragonfly, about 2.5 to 4.5 centimeters, from the tail till the head. It has a bit of coloration in its wings, but it's called the Blue Dasher because, well, they fly fast, they're dashing around. And as the insect gets older, they start to collect this sort of like blue powder, kind of waxy coating on their tail. And this is the reason they're called blue. So if it is a fresh, mature individual, you likely not see the blue color on the tail. But as they get older, with age, they collect this blue color. So this is the Blue Dasher.
So I've heard a lot of things about dragonflies. I used to work at a nature program when I was a kid at scout camp, and we had a swamp with a lot of dragonflies and damselflies. But
perfect.
I've heard that, one, dragonflies and damselflies are voracious predators, and they eat a lot of insects that we might consider a nuisance. But two, I've also heard that dragonflies can be an indicator of a healthy environment because they're a predator species and they eat a lot of things. So you need a habitat that supports a lot of different kinds of life. And so that's why maybe this study grabbed me, is because what we're talking about here is a dragonfly that has adapted to love heavily impacted bodies of water in cities and urban environments. So does it strike you as equally curious, I guess?
Yes, absolutely. So you're right, dragonflies are considered very voracious predators, both in their nymph form when they're in the water and as an adult when they are terrestrial. They're very voracious predators. They'll eat all sort of insects, including other dragonflies. Fun fact is that it is considered that they have a kill accuracy of about 95 to 97%, which is the highest in the animal kingdom. So they're better at getting their prey than I guess, lions and tigers. And also, they are a very important invertebrate group for water quality, because a lot of dragonfly species, they are very sensitive to pollution, right? And partially that is because of the reason you said, is because other invertebrates that live in water or that complete their life cycle in water, like mayflies and caddisflies, they are the prey for these dragonflies. So if those insects are not there, then these species themselves are not there. And just like mayflies and caddisflies, dragonflies also themselves are very sensitive to these pollutants themselves. So usually in a heavy polluted pond, you are not likely to find many mayflies or caddisflies, or if any at all, and you would only find a handful, maybe one or two species of dragonflies. And usually it tends to be pachydiplex. At least in North America, it tends to be pachydiplex. So it is a little unusual compared to the vast majority of other dragonflies that this species does well in these kind of habitats, because most members of the dragonflies and damselflies like more pristine water or more clear water. Yeah.
What about this creature has allowed it to survive so well, even in urban environments where water may be polluted, or, you know, there may not be a lot of water flow and other things that you might need to have an ecosystem with a lot of different diversity?
So we approached this problem or this question through the genomic lens. So we first sequenced the entire genome of this dragonfly. So we have a very good genome of this entire dragonfly. And we compared that genome to the other genomes from other dragonfly species. And one of the things that stood out is that they show expansion in genes, as in there's a lot of diversity in genes that are related to what we call peptidoglycan catabolic processes. Essentially, peptidoglycan is the thing that bacterial cell walls are made up of. And this catabolic process helps break that down, right? Now, it's not unusual to have peptidoglycan catabolic process. We have it too. We show it too, because we have gut microbiome and, you know, all the food that the gut microbiome is producing for us, you know, we need this process to break it down and make it available to us. We take nutrition that way. And most animals do as well. But in this one, it seems like the genes that are responsible for this process seem to be, the genes seem to be expanding, as in like there's more genetic diversity that we are seeing in these genes, right? Gene family expansions. And that could be an indication of them being able to survive in these kind of habitats, because they're likely also encountering a huge diversity of microorganisms that comes with polluted water, because there's already enough evidence that the microbiomes that you find in heavily polluted waters tends to be very diverse, and also, I shouldn't say tend to be very diverse, but it's a different kind of microbiome. And your overall bacterial loads are more. So that means you're encountering more of these bacteria. So it's likely that these organisms are able to elicit an effective immune response when they're encountering these bacteria.
So they've adapted their bodies have adapted to stand up to high amounts of bacteria in this water.
It could be. Yeah. It could be that this is their innate response and we've just captured it now. So that they've always had this capability, but now because there is more habitat that are, you know, polluted, that means they now have a chance to be more successful in these habitats compared to other species, because there's not a lot of species that can be successful in these kind of polluted habitats. So that's why they're doing well, whereas others are not doing well. However, if it is a relatively cleaner pond, then you would have blue dashers, but you would have a lot of other different kind of dragonflies as well. And those dragonflies are actually more successful than pachydiplex in those kind of cleaner ponds. But when it comes to handling more pollution or more temperature, because these are warmer ponds also, they seem to be doing better.
So because there's less predators, you had mentioned how some dragonflies eat other dragonflies. Because the blue dasher can live in kinds of environments that other predatory insects cannot, what does that say for its numbers? So if I see a polluted pond with a lot of blue dashers, I guess I can assume that they're doing very well in reproducing in this body of water, correct?
Yes and no, because, this was the other piece of the puzzle when we started with this project. Blue dashers tend to be very territorial, which means that they fight a lot with each other, and they try to protect the little twig that they're sitting on. They will fight for the little twig with the other males or even females of the same species and other species, because they're very aggressive that way. But then they're aerial. That means they are getting food or prey, a terrestrial prey largely, which they might have access to a lot of it. However, where they're laying their eggs might not be the most suitable habitat for their eggs, right? So there is a bit of a risk involved with that. However, because they are doing fine in these sort of depleted habitats where the prey quality is also not too much, it would suggest that they are either they are doing fine even with this depleted quality of food, or that perhaps they are laying their eggs in much better ponds, or the ponds where the quality is much better. The nymphs are surviving there, but then the adults are non-discriminate and they go everywhere, and they find food wherever they can. So it could be that, but that is one of the things we're looking to do next. Yes.
Are there other animals maybe that also live in polluted environments that behave in a similar way? Maybe not other species of dragonflies, but is this a kind of adaptability that other animals have when they live in still or polluted water?
Yes. So we definitely see an elevation in immune response, something akin to this peptidoglycan catabolic process, right? Or responses that are correlated to essentially cell redox homeostasis, which helps your body kind of find the free radicals, because, you know, these polluted environments have a lot of free radicals. So you want to protect your body against that, because that causes a lot of cell and tissue damage. So an increase in this kind of cell redox homeostasis response, or the peptidoglycan catabolase response, this is seen in other animals as well, like birds who are, you know, kind of living in more polluted environments. So that is similar. Yeah.
So Manpreet, I wanted to ask about where your research is going to take you next. I know we've talked a lot of different sort of subjects in this interview, but
yeah.
Where is your research going to take you next? Are you going to study the blue dasher some more, or look into other species as a biologist?
Well, so I do study a lot of other species. So I'll start with blue dasher first. So we do want to actually figure out what the nymph are eating. If there is nothing in the water, if there's not a lot of diversity in the water, then what are they eating? Right.
And that is dragonfly nymphs do eat a lot, and they're very big too. If you've
yes, they eat a lot, and they're very big. Exactly. So what are they eating? So that is one of the things that we want to study and figure out. The other cool thing about this particular dragonfly is the migration aspect of it. It was just believed that these guys, because they are so territorial and it's a small dragonfly that just kind of likes to perch in a small place, we assumed they don't migrate. So that was the other piece of the study that we looked at. And when we started this work, my hypothesis was that we're going to see a very structured population, which means that we would see distinct patches of population because they're not mating with each other. So they will all be just like kind of just in their own little area. But when we looked at the population structure of the species across the United States, we find that they are, in fact, mingling and mating everywhere. And we don't find a structure, so to speak, which was surprising, which was very interesting and very surprising. So somehow these insects are migrating. And migration in odonates, which is dragonflies, is a mystery in itself, because there are certain species that we know are capable of migrating, just kind of like monarchs do, but we don't understand very well their cues or what kind of, you know, kind of like mechanisms enable them to do these migrations. We still don't know what why some species are migratory versus others or not. And it seems like Pachydiplex might be migratory, because people recently, last year actually, in Rhode Island, there was a big swarm of these dragonflies, and they just completely covered the entire beaches, and it was quite a sight to behold, and a lot of them were blue dashers. So it's very interesting behavior that this organism shows, but we don't understand much about that yet. I would like to say that these are very cool looking dragonflies, and you would find them everywhere, wherever you go, but do take pictures. One part of our study was using iNaturalist data, which, you know, is citizen science data. So anyone can download the iNaturalist app, take a picture, and just upload it. But that was actually a very important part of us trying to figure out how this dragonfly is moving across the United States. So your data is very useful for us, because it actually helps us do research. So I would encourage everyone to look for dragonflies and upload photos.
I'll keep my eye out. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Manpreet Kohli's research into the blue dasher dragonfly is published in BMC Ecology and Evolution. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1822. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.